Yeah, I make games, and welcome to my podcast. I'm your host, Mrs., and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Brogan Hackett. What do you do?
Yeah, I make games.
Adam Pipe, what do you do?
Yeah, I make games.
Okay, so Brogan, what do you actually do?
Yeah, I make games. No, for real, I do actually make games for sort of a living. And I also run the Haunted PS1 low-res horror community. Not sure what else. I could go into great detail about every game I've ever made if you want.
How many have we all made? I think I've lost count.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've lost count as well, but I think I'm at like 40, probably.
Yeah, probably same.
I think at one point I counted and it was like over 50, but some of them are like it together in one download or something.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
Right. And some of them are like things I made in like half a day, just because I was bored.
Still counts.
Every game is a game.
All right, Adam, what do you actually do?
So I also make games, I do game a month every month, which is like a monthly thing where I make games. I've been doing that for like 2 years now, which is nice.
Whoa.
Yeah,
I did not realize you did that. Sorry.
Yeah, but it's not my my full time thing, yet. I work at Nitrome as well, so yeah, that's pretty much it.
Nitrome, they're the famous Flash devs, right? From like Newgrounds era,
from way back when.
Mm.
But they actually no longer make Flash games. Surprisingly.
Oh yeah.
Very surprising.
I thought it'd be super lucrative still.
Yeah, no, well, I think it's lucrative until, like, the end of December when, like, Flash dies.
All right, and I am a game developer full-time, indie, and a YouTuber. That's how I'm famous. All right.
The videos.
Yeah, doing videos.
That's good.
All right, so should we start with questions?
Okay, my question is already like too philosophical for the start of this podcast, but so I kind of do believe that when like you make games, whatever, like you kind of put like stuff from yourself in it, and it's kind of interesting how sometimes you like kind of put the same stuff into every game and you don't even like notice it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question to you guys is like, you know, what do you find yourself putting in every game, even like subconsciously, you know?
So for me, it has to be like my gender politics, I guess. So I'm transgender, I'm a trans woman, and I'm non-binary. And for years, even before I realized I was non-binary, I was like, in my head, I was like, this character uses they, them pronouns. And it's just a weird little thing where like, I was like, I want my characters to be kind of gender neutral, and so, or like for their gender to be unclear, because I do also think that makes it more relatable to the player to have like a character that could be whatever gender, or to have a character that gender is like not so important to their identity. But then when I realized I was trans, it made so much more sense. And since then I've kind of like, branched out a bit and mostly done like non-binary and female characters in my games. But I just think it's interesting that before I even knew that, I was kind of like subconsciously putting it into my games.
Yeah, that's really cool. I always wonder, like, you know, if you were like super aware of that fact, you know, like maybe you learn more about yourself, like if you studied your own games, you know, like academically or something, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think if I really like examined my motivations for it a bit closer at the time, I might have. But it's very interesting. Like I think a lot of people, when they create characters, they want them to reflect themselves, even if they're not a character who'd do the things that the person who's making them does. There's ways in which the creative tries to represent themselves in their characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like, I guess if you're writing, you're always kind of, saying stuff the way you would say it, even if you're trying your best not to do it, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like...
So, do you... Well, I guess kind of a follow-up question on that is, like, do you think it's, like, good to kind of accident, like, you know, force yourself to kind of, you know, put yourself more into your own games, you know, make, like, biopics almost?
I think in a lot of ways it is. This year I made a game called Bleak Shore for one of the Haunted PS1 jams, and that was explicitly a story about a trans woman.
And that did really well as well.
The anxiety and the fear of rejection that comes with being trans in a lot of circumstances, especially in relationships. And I think exploring that like made that game one of the highlights of my year. I've seen so many other people relate to it as well. And I think it was definitely very much worth it to go and put myself into my game like that. Not that I'm actually...
It's really interesting how, like, other people relate to it, and it's almost, like, you know, a way of communicating with people.
Yeah, and, like...
For, like, very specific emotions, kind
of. In, like, the comments and ratings on itch.io, people, like, I keep seeing people being, like, oh, I could relate to this so well, and...
That's cool.
Yeah. And so what about you, Miz?
Oh.
Like, what kind of stuff do you see, like, in your games constantly? You don't notice.
I mean, I would say every game I've done, I've always tried to have a unique twist. I feel like everything needs to be unique and stand out, and I can't do like something that's been done before, you know? It's got to be unique and special. And maybe, I mean, I could like look at my past and be like, yeah, I've always wanted to stand out in a crowd, which I mean, I do because I'm 6'6", but like, but like, yeah, I always want to be like unique and stand out, and like I think every game I've done has always had like some kind of unique twist to it. So
yeah, I was thinking that about your work recently. I think it was one of your YouTube videos I was watching, and I was like, damn, Miz always puts twists in this game.
Yeah.
What a cool guy.
Yeah, which is awesome. I mean, I love the twists always, but I wonder, is that something you've been doing, like, ever since you made your first game? Or was it, like, something you found yourself suddenly, like, oh, no, I want to stop making games that already exist, you know?
No, it was literally my first game, yeah. I was always, like, obsessed with, like, for the longest time, I was always obsessed with, like, innovation. I have to be as innovative as possible. Everything has to be unique and stand out. I think because I watched the indie game movie or something, and I, like, saw these, you know, platformers with unique twists, and I was like, whoa, so you innovative, and that's how you get famous and successful, right? So
yeah, that's really interesting, because like me personally, I kind of struggled with that a lot in the beginning, because I guess I wanted to do like innovative stuff, but I was also just like obsessed with like remaking games I liked, which I kind of see people do quite often, I guess. But it's like, and I really struggled with that, because it was really alluring to kind of just make something that already existed, you know? But then like, I think when I made like Dungeon Schmucks, which was, I think my 10th game or something, just before it, I made Tonsil Terror, which was kind of like a new thing. And then, you know, and then I made Dungeon Schmucks, which was just like a dungeon exploration game, right? And it just felt like so horrible to work on that, because it was like, why am I making this? You know, this already exists. And then I swore to myself to never, you know, try to make a genre game again, you know?
Yeah, the one thing I'd say about twists is that, like, a lot of people, when they are thinking of, say, a game for a game jam, they'll be like, what's the twist? And they never think of the contents of the story as being the twist. It's always a very mechanical thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do that think, I do think actually, Miz, your games, like, with the stories in them are always a bit of a, like, fresh twist, especially on, like, sci-fi themes that I've seen you do.
Uh-huh. I just wait till you see the world building for my game I'm currently working on. It's gonna be some cool stuff.
And it's also I think it's, like, it's good if you, like, give, you know, you do the twist in your game as well. Like, you start with something generic and then, like, a twist kind of, you know, so the people actually, like, seeing the twist. You know, and I guess in that sense, like, the story can be kind of a twist. Because you often see, like, I feel like a lot of game jam games are, like, the whole concept of the game is the twist. But then, you know, they never give you, like, the space to appreciate the twist, you know.
Oh,
as soon as you start, it's already twisted, you know. And then there's nothing to do in the game, you know. It never, you know, develops further, I guess. If that makes sense.
Well, like, with a jam, yeah, they're kind of forced to, like, do the most interesting thing right away so people actually, like, play through it. Otherwise, they'll get bored in, like, 30 seconds and not leave a review and like that.
Yeah, too.
But also, if you're making a full game, don't you kind of have to, like, put, you know, the interesting thing kind of at the beginning? Otherwise, people feel like they're getting, you know, they saw it in the trailer and, like, that's what they want to do, you know, when they buy the game.
Yeah. Yeah, too.
I do think there's a lot to be said for, like, giving players a brief glimpse of what it would be without the twist, and that sort of makes them appreciate it more.
Yeah.
Like,
story-wise, it makes sense. Right?
Yeah, I don't know if you
could, you don't put the twist
if you've both seen the game Quomp by Wombat Stuff on Twitter.
Yeah.
Well, like, the start of, like, the trailer for that is just, like, literally Pong.
Yeah,
and that was cool. He showed me an early version of the trailer for it, and I was like, okay, it's Pong. And then the ball just, like, flies out to the side of the screen and starts going on an adventure, and it's like, that's the like, feeling of wonder you get when a twist is pulled off really well.
Yeah, exactly. And wouldn't have worked if it was just a ball going on an adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it needed to be contextualized as, yeah, this was Pong, but now it's not.
It broke free.
So, my first question is, what's the most hacky thing you've done just to get a game finished?
So, literally yesterday, I was working on my game. I mean, it's not finished, but it's a pretty good hack. I had this bug where if you shoot a grenade straight up, the grenades have, like, a motion trail on them so you can see where they're going. And, like, a trail renderer kind of thing, except in a different game engine. And there's, like, this bug. If you shoot straight up, the trail glitches out and goes, like, a mile off screen. So you have this line going across the sky. And so I didn't know how the trail code worked because I just pulled it from some asset library. And I didn't want to dig through all the code to figure out how it, you know, what was going wrong. So I just made so the player can't look straight up.
That's a good rule in general in first-person games, though. Like, there's very little need to look directly up.
Yeah. I just locked it to 89.7 degrees. That's the max on the x-axis.
That's good. And then you can also, you know, you don't have to finish your skybox. Because, like, the hardest part of the skybox is always the top, but then, you know.
I think with the field of view, you can still see the top of the skybox, unfortunately.
Ah, damn.
Alright, that's the most hacky thing I've done.
That's good. I feel like my general workflow is hacky stuff, but I can tell you about, you know, my biggest nightmare during development is I think I had one game which I was for a game jam, and, like, literally 30 minutes before the game jam ended, my file got corrupted.
Oh no.
And it was like, I think that was the most stressful, like, time of my life, because I wanted to have something, and I copied all the files into a new project. I just, like, hoped it worked. and I had to like rebuild the entire like collision or something.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow.
Like the last 10 minutes. But I did like hand it in like 30 seconds before the deadline. So that's one of my biggest victories,
well done.
I think.
Game jams are too stressful.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, when I'm organizing game jams, I'm constantly like, how can I make this less stressful?
Yeah.
To the point where like most of my game jams are like a vague start time, big end time, make a game somewhere in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is great because I feel like the most important like time for a game jam is when you're just like doing nothing and avoiding the work. And then like usually your best idea hits, you know, during that time.
Yeah. So I have an answer to this question as well, which I find funny. I don't know if it's like my like hackiest thing, but when I was making my first horror game, Broken Paradox, a lot of like horror games have a lot of doors in them that are like, oh, it's jammed or whatever, and you never get to go through them. But my lock and key system didn't have an option for like jammed a door, and I didn't have time to make one. So what I did was I just said, this door requires the master key to open. The funny thing is that backfired and every player was like, where's the master key? Where's the master key? And I was like so frustrated. But also,
this is the part where you know, you should have like gone back to the game and added an entire ARG to get, you know, the master key.
I did think about doing an update with the master key, called the master key update, but then I was like, no, I don't have the energy.
That's kind of great though. I wonder if you could just like intentionally put like stuff like that in your game, just so you always have the opportunity to push updates, you know, get demand for
yeah, the game. Every locked door is an open window. That's the saying, right?
Exactly. Put a lot of locked doors in your game. You're sure to get publishing.
Oh, that just reminded me of another hack I did. It was like, did either of you play Snake Like? I can't remember. Yeah, you were in that jam, Adam.
I love Snake Like. It's great.
It's Snake, but like an action adventure game.
I think I remember watching your
The four devs video.
Yeah.
So the final level, there's like the orcs are trying to escape you and escape through this exit, and I didn't want to write a bunch of new code for like having them run and escape an exit, so they already had code for chasing villagers and they would try to kill them, and if they killed them all, you lose. So I just put an invisible villager at the exit, and then the orcs would run and try to kill it, and then if they killed it, I just changed the lose message to, you know, they escaped instead of they killed a villager, and then it worked. But then during the jam, somebody actually killed that villager with the snake, and I was like,
"That was me."
Yeah, that was you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, maybe I should have put it somewhere else or something.
Behind a wall.
Yeah, but it was great. It was kind of like a philosophical, you know, because it gave like a message, like something about like you killed the, and I thought the castle was alive.
Yeah.
And really added a lot of lore to the game.
Unintentional lore.
Yeah.
All right. I'll just jump into my question, I guess. I think I'll start with, what do you think is the objectively the worst game mechanic ever?
I'm gonna let Morgan go first.
Oh, okay. My least favorite, probably the objectively worst mechanic is QuickTime events. Just like every time one of them flashes up on screen, my brain fills with static and I miss it until I've tried it 3 more times.
I don't know. Those are just like,
but
they just like ruin the tension.
I feel like, you know, to play like Devil's Advocate, I wouldn't know what else you would do there. If you had like a very specific animation and you needed it for like cinematic reasons or whatever, you know, it's like a good solution to get like, oh, this is a cinematic. But
just
it's
play the cinematic,
I think games
though
could do it trying less to be cinematic and trying more to have better flow.
Yeah.
Did you see that clip from the Avengers where they just pause it if you don't hit the quick time?
No, I didn't see that. That sounds hilarious, though.
Yeah. So they didn't want, I guess they didn't want to animate the superhero losing or whatever. Because that's, you know, it usually happens if you mess up a quick time. So they just pause the game. It's like, okay.
I think, I do think, though, that quick time events, like, can work as audio, or as dialogue prompts, where you're, like, in the break, in the conversation, you can say something and you have, like, time to say it. But that's, I think that's not quite a quick time event.
Yeah, in some ways. It's kind of different.
Yeah, it could also be rough for people who have a hard time reading, like if they're dyslexic. That's true, or something.
Yeah, I've had that happen a few times where I haven't had time to read the response before.
Yeah, too. I think, like, the worst game mechanic, in my opinion, is, like, Health Bars.
Really?
I think it's like, okay, but they can work if they are on you, but, like, on enemies, because it's just, like, I feel like every time I push a button, you know, and it's like a shooter game or whatever, you know, I'd want, you know, the thing that I'm pointing at to, like, explode or whatever, you know. But, like, a health bar is, like, the most anticlimactic thing that could happen. It's just, that's like, true. A small sliver of a pixel goes away, and that's it, you know. And that sucks so much. It's like Borderlands. I really Borderlands, really, just for that reason. Because it's just, like, you're just constantly, like, pointing, you know, your screen towards this enemy and pressing the mouse button, and that's it, and that's the entire game, and it's so boring, you know.
Yeah,
because there's like no end to it, and the bosses get harder, as in, you know, the health bar is bigger.
Yeah,
it's so boring.
I don't know, though, like, I love seeing how far I am in, say, Dark Souls on a health bar on a boss.
I guess it can work in some things, but I guess it's like, for some reason, it's, like, worse than in shooters, for some reason.
Yeah.
Just because it's so...
Yeah, well...
I guess, like...
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess it's just... I don't know. There's something about, like, shooters where you expect more to happen, you know?
What I was gonna... What I was gonna say is that I think it makes you more aware when an enemy is a bullet sponge.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. That's true. And I guess it will work more if, like... You know, your health bar goes away, but, like, your arrows stick inside of him or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If there's just like, something else going on than just the health bar, it's fine, usually.
Yeah.
But
if the only reaction to your bullet is literally just, like, a sliver of health disappearing, it's kind of...
I think it can work for boss fights, but for just, like, regular small enemies, it's just a chore. And it's just, like, you'd like to just pop them and they die kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's really, I feel it's mostly about, like, overstaying its welcome, I guess, you know? If it's too long, it just gets really fucking boring.
Yeah.
I guess that's true for most different games, so.
Let's see, I think the objectively the worst game mechanic ever has got to be random encounters. The only reason they've ever existed was because of technical limitations on old consoles. But because there's a lot of famous games that had them, now people are like, oh, that's what made them good. So when we make JRPGs now, they got to have lots of random encounters. And it just takes you so much out of the action. It's like, I want to see what happens next in the story. And you got to, like, walk somewhere. And then every three steps, it just play just the music. And then 10-second intro. And then you, like, mash the Xbox button to, like, one hit all these enemies. And then it plays, like, a 20-second outro. And then, like, you're back in the regular game. You walk five more steps and it happens again. And it's just, like, the most annoying thing. And, like...
Yeah, it kind of is. But I think it's, like... It's more like, you know, I don't know what's the word, but it's more you know, it's not really the mechanic itself that's a problem. It's more like the game, you know, that needs it, you know. Because, like, for example, like, I really love Earthbound, just like, you know, like, the looks and how it plays and whatever. And the random encounters have, like, really cool music and stuff, so I love them. But it's just like, if it really gets to this gameplay where you have to, at some point in the game, you have to run in circles.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know,
otherwise you can't proceed. And actually, when I played Earthbound, I didn't run in circles enough, and then I got to the next area, and I wasn't at a high enough level, and then I was just stuck, because all the random encounters were, like, too high level for me to beat.
I think that's actually, like, I'm a big fan of Pokemon, and... random encounters have always been in that game, and they used to bother me a lot when I was younger. I still do. In fact, it's the reason I stopped playing, I think, Pokemon Moon. But in Sword and Shield, I think the wild area actually improved upon that, because you have a lot of choice in how you approach tall grass, or you can see a lot of Pokemon in the world. And I think that actually really improves it.
Yeah, I feel like I have a lot of gripes with like RPGs kind of like that in general. Just like, I don't know, I don't like turn-based combat that much, but I feel like, you know, it's better when you can kind of have some, you know, have some control over it.
Yeah.
Like when you, you know, like in Earthbound, when there's like an enemy runs into you, you know, they attack first, but if you can like run into them or something, you can attack first. Yeah. And that makes it much more interesting. Yeah.
I think there's a lot to be said for giving your battle system life as well. Like, if you look at like the clinically designed UIs of some of the Pokemon games, or like the default blue boxes of like Final Fantasy VII or whatever, they don't feel like anything really. But if you look at like I'm pretty sure Earthbound does this, but I haven't played much of it, and I haven't played it in a couple of years, but like it has those cool backgrounds and as you said, the music and stuff, and like it just feels better. And also I think a game that did like random encounters quite well was Undertale, because it's like you get a series of little mini games to play through.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like somehow in some games it feels like it's tacked on, you know. Well, it should be like the main thing for some reason, you know.
It's just kind of like a blind grind.
Yeah, but I in my opinion, the best RPG is still like old, you know, Paper Mario games, because it's just like turn based and like encounters and whatever. But it's perfect just because when you do an attack, you can like time it and then you hit more. And that's like the only thing I need in these kinds of games, is just something like tactile.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you played Lost Odyssey on Xbox 360? They had a combat system like that. Okay. Yeah, it was a pretty interesting JRPG, but hasn't been ported to anything else, annoyingly.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Especially when it's Xbox. I mean, I don't want to start a console war, but it's like...
I think I've heard of Lost Odyssey, actually. I think I've heard someone talking about it, like, really, really into it. But, like, obviously it doesn't exist. Or it doesn't exist for us to play, like, easily now.
Yeah.
Which is a shame.
Yeah, you can't. Just need an emulator for... Just need the... Whatever the 360 emulator
and a legally procured ROM, right?
Yeah, legally procured ROM. But emulation's not there yet. Almost. But for random encounters, I feel like it's... You can really, like, tell thoughts on it or attitudes towards it, because every JRPG that comes out has an option to turn them off now. And it's like, it's just like, what's the point of putting it in now? Like, every time I see like an indie JRPG come up, that's like one of their advertised features, is that you can turn it off. And it's like, why even put it in then? Like,
yeah. I feel like that's true for so many like settings. I mean, there's like a lot of good like accessibility stuff, and like being able to turn off screen shake is nice.
Yeah.
And stuff. But it's also, it hurts to implement. You know,
yeah,
because it's like you have this vision of how your game should look and like final edit because accessibility, and it's good, but at the same time it hurts knowing someone is playing this game without screen shake, you know.
Hey, we're like, all indie. Like
they'll uncover that your game is actually not good
at all. We're all indie devs here. We all worship at the feet of screen shake.
Yeah.
You take our screen
shake like
away.
You're a triple A studio when you don't let screen shake. I guess I'll go on to my second question. Again, it's like very, what is my life? But what would you pursue if you didn't do games? And whatever it is, like in a different medium or a different occupation, do you think like games could learn from that?
So I have a few answers to this. Some of them might be a little jokey, but the first one is living in a coffin because I'm dead. a more serious one would be like just a boring office job where I don't have to do all this thinking, which is still kind of funny, but
that's interesting though, because like I wouldn't, if I do like a job where I didn't have to do like a lot of thinking, I wouldn't pick like an office job, because that's already pretty close to what games is. Mm-hmm. You have to sit behind your computer
all the time, actually, you know? That's true, now that I think about it, when I do like think seriously about like if I were to change career, a lot of the time I'm like, I'd love to do something outside so I could come home and like sit in front of my computer and feel not bad about sitting in front of my computer to play games after a day's work, sitting in front of my computer making games.
Definitely.
So like gardening or something could be pretty cool, but also a lot of those jobs are fairly low paying. But I think...
I hope they...
go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I hope they one day like figure out some kind of really like comfortable working station that's not super awkward that you can just do outside. You know? That would be incredible.
I think like games could totally like learn from like gardening. I think there needs to be gardening games. I had a cool idea a while back for one, but it would take a lot of effort that I don't think I could make it myself right now, but it's an idea that's floating in my head at least. And my last answer to this would be I would be a troll living under a bridge, threatening people as they go across unless they give me money. I think that's a very lucrative career choice.
That's good. But I feel like it's also a double thing, because I feel like a lot of the other options are just like escapism to, you know, like sitting behind a computer and doing creative stuff. But then at the same time, it's probably like more stressful, because, you know, if you're doing like a really dumb job or something, you know, not they are dumb jobs, but if you just pick something because you think, oh, I wouldn't have to like actively think about this while doing it. Maybe like while you're doing it, you'll constantly be thinking, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Which is probably more emotionally taxing than actually working on games.
But anyway, I think the bridge troll one is the most reasonable, because you don't have to pay rent to live under a bridge, and
you can
set your own toll. If people don't have 100 euros to give you, that's their problem. You're a big troll and they can't beat you.
What would you spend your money on if you didn't pay rent?
My sick rig that runs off of the power socket that's clearly under the bridge.
Makes total sense. What about you, Miz?
Well, before I started making games, I was super into art and I wanted to start a webcomic. I was reading a bunch of webcomics and I was like, wow, these people are doing this full time. And I was like, that's cool. And I started like world building some stuff and thinking about all this. Like, I don't know how I was going to make this sick fantasy webcomic. And then... I wasn't very good at art yet. I was still like learning, and then I was like, wait, what if I made a game? And then I got into making games. So, but if I hadn't done that, I would have probably been a full-time artist by now. And I guess I probably would have ended up making zines or something if I did do games off of that. I guess that zines are like the visual visual comics, right?
Zines,
visual novels.
I pronounce it zines anyway.
Zines? Oh, I don't know how to pronounce it.
You should totally check out if there's like some, well, when people can go outside and go to events and stuff again, you should check if there's zine fairs in your area, because they're zine really fairs. Cool to go to.
Zine fairs?
Zine fairs. They're like places where people just sell their zines.
That's cool. Oh,
that's awesome. God, that's like one of those things that I would never see anyone do in Belgium, probably. So...
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, but it sounds awesome.
I did slightly consider accounting, because I took an accounting class and I actually kind of liked it, which is weird, I feel like, but I don't know how games could learn from accounting. Balance your checkbook in game.
Honestly, if I had a game that would actually like teach me how to balance my checkbook, which is at all like interesting, that would
That would actually be good amazing. If I could like learn how to run my game making business by just playing a game. That would be pretty awesome.
Game dev tycoon, but like actually realistic.
Game dev tycoon, but without all the cool decisions and more like filling out documents.
A lot of that stuff isn't like globally applicable, though.
Oh, like, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So it would be kind of a slim market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, soon.
But I think actually art is something I could have gone into as well, but I kind of like... Mm. Both my brothers went into art, and so that kind of like scared me off a bit, I guess.
You want to be unique. Scared my parents off a lot more.
That's interesting. Yeah, I feel like, yeah, it's like to me, like I was also definitely like in art, and I feel like I was just like looking for the type of art I want to do, and then I figured out games was like what I was most comfortable in, you know?
Yeah.
Which is why I probably started doing it or like taking it seriously, you know? Mm-hmm. But if I would be doing something else, I would probably want to do movies. Probably because I'm just like obsessed with movies recently. And it's like, you always used to be like, oh, games are so much better than movies. There's so much more you can do in games than you can do in movies. And now lately, I'm like watching movies like, oh, you could never do this in a game.
Well, the thing is, there's so much more you can do in games than you can do in movies. But none of those things are being done.
Yeah, that's true. But it's like, yeah, sometimes you watch a movie and just like two human beings talking to each other. And it's like, yeah, I could do that in games, but like, I don't know. Yeah. I want to, you know, it's so hard to do. Like, either you make your really shitty human models and then like making it not look goofy is incredibly difficult. You know, if I want to do like something emotional or whatever, or you go like super big budget and then you can get away with it. But at that point, why not just make a movie, you know?
Then there's also the problem you have to make it interactive. And it's like, what if they don't choose the coolest option? It's going to be the most emotional or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's great. I mean, I think it's like, I feel like you should be doing with games what you can't be doing with movies instead of like trying to, you know, get movies to work in games, you know? But it is frustrating, you know, sometimes. But yeah.
All right.
So I guess I'll ask my next question now.
Yeah, go ahead.
So my question is, you've been approached by a AAA company and given a massive budget to make whatever you want, but it has to be an adaptation of an existing IP that doesn't have games already. What do you make?
I think Redwall. I don't think they have any games for Redwall, but I like Redwall.
What's it?
Okay, so it's like fantasy, but with animals that have swords and stuff. And it's kind of like they're children's books, I guess. And they like live in a forest and they have this castle called Redwall. And they all get attacked by like evil creatures that are also animals. And I don't know, I always thought it was really cool. And then I saw... what's the rabbit game? Overgrowth, right? And I was like, oh, that's what it could be. Something like that. And then, I don't know, I always thought like for a long time I was like wanting to make like a Redwall fan game. And then I just thought it would be cool to have like, I don't know, like a game where you play as a squirrel archer and you like run up trees and have to like, you know, jump off of them, run off trees, off like acrobatic stuff, flipping through the air, shooting arrows, that kind of thing.
I think I think there is a few games that are like inspired by Redwall. Like the one probably, that comes to mind is the board game Root, which is really good actually. But
board game what?
Root? It's called Root. You play as like one of four different factions in like a forest, and each of the factions is different kinds of animals. So there's like the fascist cats and the aristocratic birds and there was like the woodland creatures who are rebels against those two groups, and then the last one is you play as like a bandit who's a raccoon. And you basically play your own little like tabletop RPG around other factions, doing like jobs for them and fighting them and stuff.
Oh, that's cool. That sounds really fun.
Yeah, it's very good. Anyway, there's a few other games I've seen that are kind of like Redwall. But I can't remember the names of them right now, so I think it has been done, but not as like an official Redwall game, which would be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've heard people talking about it for a long time, and there was like a Kickstarter and it looked like total garbage, so it was like the usual, you know. Yeah, Adam, I guess.
Yeah, I'd probably pick like a movie, which is goes against what I've just said, but I'm not consistent, okay? But I would do like, I'd do like Criterion Collection with its games, you know? Because it's just like, I feel like a lot of like the adaptations for movies are usually kind of like blockbuster stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And it would be really cool to see like games based on like kind of more, you know, like art movies and stuff, or just like, you know, quite the kind of stuff you see in like Criterion Collections. I think that would be really interesting. And then like maybe getting like the director involved or something, you know.
What are Criterion Collections?
That would be cool. Well, it's just like basically they, when a movie kind of gets like a classic status or something, it gets added to like the Criterion Collection, which remasters it or whatever. That's what I think it is. But they do like series of Criterion Collections, which is usually like around the director, like recently, or like a team. Like recently they did like New Korean Cinema, which kind of, you know, they pick like movies that are kind of like historically significant. So like they don't just pick the best South Korean movies, but like the first one by Bong Joon-ho, or like, you know, the first one where, you know, Song Kang-ho did like a big role or whatever, you know. And they also pick like, and they also just release movies as well, and it's usually more like smaller movies or like not really indie, sometimes indie, but also just like kind of alt movies, and it's really interesting. And I think that would like work great for like a game, especially if like you can get like the director involved or something. Doing something that's like completely the polar opposite of what a game is, you know.
So would you have like maybe one film that you've watched from the Criterion Collection that you think would be an interesting adaptation into a game?
Yeah, or like a Criterion Collection, you know. It's like a collection of movies, and they get like big, you know.
Yeah, but one for every single
directors. You
but
know?
I'm asking more for like an example of what you would.
An example, I think, just stuff like seeing like, for example, like House or something, which is just like such. It's kind of like a cult classic. I'm sure you know.
Oh yeah, I love House MD.
House MD, yeah. As in like the series?
Yeah, it's the TV series about the doctor. And all the patients always have like a mystery to solve about their illness, basically.
That would be great as well. I meant like the movie, like like the Japanese, like J-Hole.
I knew that. I was just kind of joking. Oh, okay. Because
it's really twisting
when you
What's it about? I haven't seen this.
It's really good. It's just like, imagine like, it's by this director, and he does really weird fucking editing for all of his movies. And it's just, it's about basically like a haunted house or something. And it's a bunch of Japanese schoolgirls go there, and like their aunt is like a ghost or something. But it's really weird, and it doesn't make any sense. And all of the scenes are just like in a completely different, like ridiculous set with ridiculous lighting, and like the editing is just really weird, but it's wonderful. And just something like that, because it's like, it's obvious that like, you know, it's like these directors, it's super like a movie, you know, it wouldn't work in a game, but it just, maybe if I had like infinite money, I could hire them and like make a game, and they're like, what, I don't know how to make games.
Right, so my answer to this question is actually, so I sometimes comfort reread like books I read when I was a kid, and recently I've been rereading the Percy Jackson series. I don't know if you guys have read them, but they're basically like set in modern America where the Greek gods actually exist, and they focus on half-bloods, which are like when gods have children with humans, basically. But I think it would be really cool as like an RPG, because the books are already laid out like almost like D&D campaigns, where there's like traversal sections and then there's encounters, and like some parts of them are almost like dungeons and stuff. So I think it would make a really cool RPG game. And because you have that, like, this character is the son of Poseidon or whatever, you have like this framework for characters like special abilities already built in, and they focus a lot on like combat and stuff, and I think it could make like a really cool like turn-based RPG or something where you're road tripping across America fighting Gorgons and Cyclops and stuff.
I bet there's a tabletop RPG yeah, based awesome. On it.
I looked it up, and there's like a DS game, but it didn't look like it was what I was imagining, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, a tabletop RPG, like D&D or something.
Oh, that would be really cool as well.
Probably already systems for it. I mean, if you Google it.
Yeah, well, I'd say there's like fan systems or something. It does seem like a perfect like setup, though.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just saying that sounds really cool.
Yeah, like as I've been reading the books, I've been like, I want to play this.
Oh, the classic struggle of the game developer. Every time we see something cool, you know, that would make a really good game. That would make a really good game.
Yeah, actually, that's what I would do if I had a AAA budget. I'd just, like, every time I had, like, a fleeting idea for a game, I would just send it to them and they have to make it for me within a week.
Adam, how dare you make your developers crunch like that?
Sorry.
All right. So, shall I go?
Yeah.
All right. What's your most controversial game dev opinion?
I guess I'll get canceled first, so I'll I guess it isn't really that controversial, I think, among game devs, but I really, like, the more I think about it, the more, like, big games are kind of worthless, you know? You know, I feel like, especially, you know, when you do, like, really small games, you kind of, you're going with your games, you know? Well, if you do, like, a really long game, I don't believe that, like, a creator, you know, stays the same within, like, a month or something, you know? So it's really, like, frustrating to see. I feel like, yeah, it would be cool if you could see people, like, develop more through their games, you know? I mean, we do, like, a lot of small games, so I guess that's kind of true for us, maybe. But it's, I think it's, like, games can be like a good way to look inside of like a developer, you know? And if they make like a lot of small games, you can actively see like all the different things that like interest them and like, you know, them figuring out like what they want to actually make, you know? And I feel like such a big game, either like too many people work on it that it doesn't feel like personal at all. Or like you work on it for so long that you don't believe in it by the time you finish it.
Yeah.
You know?
So you're talking about like longer dev times being
But it's not just longer dev times. I feel like if you feel really sure about something, you should definitely make a longer game. But it's just like, yeah, I feel like doing a lot with a game is kind of worthless, maybe. I think it's cooler to do like very like one very specific thing and do it well, you know.
So my answer is actually very similar, but it's a bit more explicit in that I think the games industry would be healthier if every big game was half length and our size, and had the same budget or
and less people working on it as well.
Less people are just more time.
I feel like less people is kind of important, though, because, like, because, like, a lot of people, at some point, your game has to be kind of big to accommodate for all of those people, you know?
Yeah, that's true, too.
And that's what makes the game so absolutely, like, too much, because it's...
sorry, what I was going to say is that I think even if you had the same amount of people, it would just mean less crunch.
Yeah. Yeah, true, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, definitely, also, you know, whatever helps you do less crunch is great.
If you did cut the time in half, you would, like, probably have a shorter dev time, even if you did, like, take it easier. And I think probably we'd get more games, and studios would explore more ideas. They'd get more space to explore ideas.
Yeah, for sure. And also, I think it's like maybe it's more like a bigger movement where maybe we need to like convince consumers to want to play more games. You know,
yeah.
I don't think most people finish most big open world games though.
Yeah, for sure. And that's like one part of it, but like also another part is like with movies, for example, you know, you can create like kind of a really with kind of low budget and like one person one person doing directing and all the people doing, you know, it can be like really small teams and like really low budgets, and it can still be like a fine movie because the only thing that people want in a movie is 2 hours, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's great because like the consumers are like super ready to pay like $7 to see something that's 2 hours, you know? And if we can get to that point with games, you know, we could be making so much more games and like exploring so much more ideas. Yeah.
Yeah, Supergiant's been doing pretty good with their whole no crunch thing, and they're like releasing a new game every like year or two, it seems like. And it's like,
sorry.
I was just, go ahead. Like, yeah, I got nothing.
I just saw yesterday, I think it was someone saying about how they had like a no weekend emails, rule and, basically forced time off.
Yeah,
and it's really like I feel like some of the most like beloved games are actually really small games, you know. Especially like back in the day, you know, I feel like the game industry is definitely like developing, you know, converging more to longer stuff. But I feel like in early games, you know, you had like super good Nintendo games, but actually they had like, you know, like 10 people working on it or something, or like 5 people working on it. And that was like normal back then.
Yeah.
And that was like a DS game. And like now suddenly that's like illegal or something. I don't know.
It wasn't like the first Doom, like 4 people or something, 5 people.
Yeah.
One person for the game.
Yeah, I'm sure like WarioWare even, which is kind of like a huge game, it's really not like the team was really like kind of small actually.
Yeah,
and that's also what made it so good, because like the less people you have, like the more, you know, the more vision there is.
Yeah, the more focus. Yeah.
Yeah, which is great. So I guess this isn't really that controversial. <for Olivia. laughs>
I don't know,
but the gamers will hate us for sure.
We're, we're all game developers, so thinking about like dev cycles like this is. We're closer to it, whereas gamers are further from it, and they just want lots of people to throw lots of energy at, like, making the most impressively, like, graphically impressive, longest game possible.
Yeah. And, like, but it's done right, because, like, the reason for that is because we have to pay like $60 for huge games, you know? But if we all did, like, a bunch of small games, and it was, like, totally normal to pay, you know, $5 to $7 for something that's like 2 hours, which movies is, you know, then that would be like amazing.
I feel like as a dev, my expectations of games have changed also. Like before, I used to be like, I want some massive game where you can go anywhere and do anything and break everything and create anything. And now I'm just like, I just want like some small thing that's like fun and interesting and does something cool. And it's like,
For sure.
If a game's gonna let me do everything, it needs to provide it as a sandbox and not as like a so structured an experience. One of my favorite games is Forza Horizon 4, which is just like, you get a car, you get the English countryside, you can drive across all of the hills.
Yeah, that's great. And it's like, yeah. But I think the history of games proves that this model does work. So I don't think we've outgrown that or something. I feel like that's what gamers think, that like games will forever keep expanding,
yeah,
until we finally get to the ultimate game. Yeah.
The ultimate game.
Which is so dumb, but yeah, whatever.
Let's see. All right, so I got a couple controversial opinions. Let's see. I'll go with, I think game design channels run by people who have never made a game before on YouTube, I think those are kind of dumb, and you can't really learn anything from them.
Yeah, I've seen a few game channels where it's like, this person doesn't have a link to any game they've made, and they also have 10 projects on the go.
Mm. It's like, there's like this game you can play with like YouTube game developers where it's like, they do like a few game jams, and then every single one of them always eventually releases a video where it's like, I'm going to make my dream game. And then like, it's just, it's so painful to see. You know?
Oh man, everyone's making their magnus opus dream game.
Yeah, actually, that's another opinion of mine that might be controversial. It's that you shouldn't make your dream game until you've successfully released. If your dream game is going to be commercial, unless you've successfully released some commercial games already.
Yeah, I would go even like more extreme than just say that like your dream game should never make your dream game, because it will never exist. Yeah. By the time you'll have enough experience to be able to make your dream game, you won't want to make
your dream game. Yeah, it won't be your dream game either.
My dream game when I first started was an MMO with super cool melee combat. Now I think back to it, I'm like, that was the dumbest idea. Like, that would have been so bad.
Exactly. And see, it's like, that's like, again, like, you know, like my thing where it's like, it hurts so much when someone is like, I'm gonna work on this for a year, but because you'll know like by the half the year they'll realize this is not what they want to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Back to the game design channels. I feel like a lot of the channel it's like people who really like playing games, and so they make videos talking about game design, but then it's like they've never made a game, so it's like, it feels like a lot of these videos, like somebody teaching guitar, but they've never played guitar, so they make an hour-long video essay on why it's important to tune your guitar. And that's like the whole
thing. Everyone in the comments is like, you're right, I'm going to make my dream game as well. And it's just absolute slaughter.
It's like, you know, somebody who hasn't played guitar, and so they make an hour-long video essay on the importance of tuning your guitar, and they show all these, like, musicians, and it's like, see, they tuned their guitar when they play, that's why, and you can see their songs are great. And it's like, if you've ever played, you're like, that's not what, like, how is that useful in any way for you to say this? Like, and that's a lot of these like game design videos feel like to me.
I've definitely seen a few videos where it's like, that should just be intuitive.
Yeah.
Especially like, if you made like one game that is intuitive and it's something that doesn't need to be pointed out.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's just like, you know, like the people who are really, really good at games are at that point so disenchanted with games that they don't want to make videos about it. You know.
But like the thing is, I really admire people like that enthusiasm.
Yeah.
I just wish they would direct it slightly differently.
Yeah, that's what like weirds me about, is like, you're so enthusiastic, but you've never thought to even try. Like, you've never even like, because it's like so easy. I feel like it's so easy to get started making games now. Like, you just pick up RPG Maker even or something.
Yeah.
Or make a tabletop. Mm. And it's like, you're so enthusiastic about it, why don't you just try? And then you can actually apply everything you're talking about and see if it actually works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. But it's also, there's like, you have Game Dev Unlocked, which is pretty good. Because the guy who owns it actually knows how to make games, you know. And his videos are pretty good. But then also they have like, he has like the energy of being so good that he's kind of full of himself, you know.
Relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's this Mrs. guy. And he makes these videos under just like,
All he does is complain about people.
I almost started out as a drama channel. I was going to make a whole video calling out these game design channels and like why they're dumb. And then I was like, wait, I don't want to be known for this. I want to be known for games.
Although it would be good marketing, probably.
Probably, yeah, but then everyone would hate me and dislike bomb my videos, probably.
Yeah, and you'll get like $1 million because people want to see what the evil man makes. Yeah. It's probably why Peter Molyneux sells all of his games.
How did he lie this time?
Yeah, exactly. Morbid curious.
My other controversial opinion, I think game devlogs on YouTube are very boring. Nearly everyone I watch are so boring, I think.
I think it's really hard to do. I think it's only interesting if you like only show results or something.
You know? Only do what?
I think it's like you can make it interesting if you either only show results and like make it very quick and snappy. Yeah. Or you go like very in depth so that like the few people that are actually genuinely interested will think it's the best thing ever made. Mm-hmm. You know?
I think there's like a grid of like a 2x2, like where every devlog can be kind of like fit into this grid of like on the top you got funny and not funny, and then on the left you've got interesting and not interesting. And then it's like so there's devlogs, like I think most of the popular YouTubers are like they fall into funny but not very interesting game. It's kind of like a generic game. And then most devlogs in general fall into not very interesting, not funny commentary. And it's like very rare to get something that's not one of those. Like I think Sebastian Lake, he goes into the interesting category. Right. Because he actually makes he's like a good example of like some, I think he's like the only devlog I actually enjoy watching. Just showing off you know, interesting algorithms and stuff and like showing off cool stuff. But most devlogs just kind of feel like a grocery list kind of monologue.
When I saw discover your channel, Miz, it was just like, to me, that was like, it was finally a man who's preaching the truth, you know?
Yeah, I remember it felt so good. I like sold the 4devs 1 art kit videos and I like binged all of them, and then I think I messaged Miz just saying like, that's so cool.
I think I watched a really old video of like how to make games or something. Now that you've chosen Unity, you know. And then I subscribed pretty much.
That was my first thing that went viral, because it started as an Imgur post that gained like, it got like thousands of upvotes or whatever it's called on Imgur. Really? And then I deleted it on Imgur. All right, well, that's all then. Anything anyone wants to promote?
You can find me on Twitter at BrogonHackett. That's spelled a bit weird. BrogonHackett. And you can find me on itch.io at boaheck.itch.io, BoaHeck.
Yeah, and I make games every month, and I'll probably be making one this month as well. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, you can find me on papercookies.itch.io. And there's a link to my Twitter there, because I don't want to try and pronounce my Twitter handle. So...
Nice. And then I'm Mrs. Izzes, so that's an M and 4 IZs. You can follow me on YouTube and Twitter, and that's my main spots for me. All right, cool. Links in the description for everything.
Thanks for listening.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe. Ring that bell.
Let us know who you'd want to see on the next one also.
Smash the notification.
Smash the...